This is Tim McHenry, producer of the Rubin Museum of Art, and you are listening to the Red Book Dialogues on WNYC's Talk to Me series.
I brought a sandwich so you can have your dinner with Andre.
All right. So we're back. You're going back in time already, 25 years or so. In the this image that I have chosen is going even back further than that. I think that we just start with the opening of this sacred red book version. I will ask Andre to just tell what he sees here, what comes to his mind as he opens this folio and looks at the image. And this is a starting point. We can go from that point any place.
I have just one thought before
right.
we begin.
Okay.
Because I think probably there's a great big white elephant in the corner there. And the white elephant is the very bizarre blurb that I think was either in the program about my father having been a spy for Hitler. So in order to shoot the white elephant, I should point out that while Sylvester may get into that, since we no longer live, thank God, in the Bush years, you can't get... But be careful, the devil is everywhere. Since we no longer live in the Bush years, you're innocent until you're proven guilty, which of course was not true in the Bush years. So my father, who may have been a spy for Hitler and for Schacht, we don't have evidence yet that he was, even though I'm investigating it for my own private reasons. The private reasons, I think, don't so much have to do with my father, because he's now gone. He died many years ago, and you can never know who another human being is who has lived in another time. But have any of you seen The Shining? Yes? That was a documentary about my childhood. And the guy in the movie was my father. A very strange, very enigmatic, often frightening, mysterious man who I only was alone with twice in my entire childhood, and each time I went blind. So when I first got involved with this, I happened to mention that I just got shingles on the opening night of my play in London, which was when I discovered that my father may have been a spy for Hitler. How many of you have had shingles? Yeah. For those of you who have not had shingles, there is an injection you can get, which... My real profession is corner rabbi and corner doctor.
Okay.
Although I think that the shingles came as a way of somehow cleansing my system of the horrible possibility, because I'm a Jew, that my father may have worked for Hitler. But I did get shingles about 20 years ago. As you know, you who've had them, they're extremely painful, and there's no medicine for them. Although my son-in-law, who's in the audience, did help me a little bit because his brother's a doctor. But at that time, I bumped into John Avedon, you know, who wrote the book about the Dalai Lama getting out of Tibet. And I was telling him what pain I was in, and he sent me to the Dalai Lama's doctor, who took my pulse, and His Holiness's doctor gave me an herb wrapped in gold paper. And he said, put this in a very dark place for 48 hours. Don't let any feminine energy near it. Not a woman, not a chicken, not a dog. He said, if you were a woman, I would say the same thing. Don't let any masculine energy near it. And at the end of 48 hours, take the gold paper off and eat it, which I did. And about half an hour later, I began to sob uncontrollably. And I sobbed for most of the day, and the shingles were gone. So I think these shingles came to me out of the pain of making this possible discovery.
How did you discover, actually, such a thing?
It is very upsetting. Yes, it's very upsetting. Particularly, well, you know what's interesting is that I have probably read every single book ever written about Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, Stalin, Trotsky. So there may have been in me, even as a child, some kind of unconscious sense of what was in the house, if in fact it was in the house. But one of my brothers called me in London the day the play was opening, and he had seen in a book written by a Princeton historian that my father and his brother had been hired by Hitler and Schott, the finance minister. They were brilliant Jewish businessmen, to try to destroy the French economy because Hitler had called a conference in Lausanne to try to get the European powers to pull back on reparations. And they thought that if they could ruin the French economy, France would come to the conference in a weakened position. So there is this one paragraph in this book which is about globalization. But the source of this information comes from the French Sûreté, which is, of course, our equivalent of Secret Service, which is quite notorious itself for having collaborated with the Germans, for having... So it's not sure that this is reliable.
But your shingles definitely responded from that side.
Oh, yeah, no. The shingles were real. And, of course, they do say that the sins of the fathers are visited on the children, so that if in some way these sins have been visited on me, then what is the purpose of investigating this? And I feel that our entire life is somehow a process of self-discovery, and that these devils that are within us are devils that somehow or other we have to confront in order to somehow move towards the light. I don't mean in a new age sense. Here's a nice story. You know Erland Josephson, the actor? He's one of Ingmar Bergman's great actors. Mm-hmm. And I had a screening of My Dinner with Andre for Peter Brook's company, many of whom had not seen My Dinner with Andre. And, of course, Erland Josephson is one of the great legendary actors. And we went out for lunch afterwards. I don't think there's a greater actor in the whole world. And he said something absolutely beautiful to me at lunch. He said, because then I think he was close to 80, he said, you know, all my life I have trained as an actor. I have trained my voice. I have trained the emotions. I have trained my body. If I could, he said, and I don't know where I would do it, I would go to train that other thing. You know what I mean, he said. That other thing that would allow me to come onto the stage and by simply standing there be so authentic and so simple that I would be like a lighthouse giving clarity and hope to the audience. So I think in a way I'm trying to deal with these devils, if devils they are, simply to be one tiny little step further.
And to radiate that kind of clarity and simplicity that...
Hopefully. Like you, I'm a slob, so whether we can ever reach that...
Well, that's a helpless thing for slobs. Too much darkness for...
Yes, once when I was in Poland, many years ago, I met a young man. He had no idea who I was. And he looked into my eyes. Only a Pole could say something so wonderful. He said, I look into your eyes, and I see the saddest optimist I've ever met.
No, that's better than seeing a soul in somebody else's eyes with the old president.
Yes.
Wow, so...
But I think also, I shouldn't talk so much, but I'll sound like a character in a certain movie. But also, I think what is interesting about this thing that came up with my father and my own soul-searching and questioning, which, of course, millions of young Germans have had to do, who were their fathers, who were their grandfathers, is that I think the concept of evil has gone out of fashion in this country. There was a great... Do any of you know the Jungian analyst Baines? Yeah, Baines wrote, in 1939, he wrote a paper. He was perhaps the first psychohistorian, is that what you call it? And he had done a study of the German family. And by studying the German family psychologically, he came to the conclusion, which at that time was very radical, that Germany would lose the war based on the position of the father in the German family. Not only did he predict that Germany would lose the war, but his last sentence of his paper was that when this war is lost by Germany, there will be a tendency to punish the Germans as if the evil was specific to the Germans themselves instead of a disease of the West. And if we don't confront that reality, that evil is real, we will be bitten in the ass like by a bumblebee. So I think given these 8 awful years we've been through, we've imprisoned people without trial, without reason, we've murdered people, we've attempted to destroy the Constitution, there is the big question, how are each one of us responsible for what happened? So that's why I've been involved with this little
I mean, that's a good point to open the book. Because okay. I have chosen. I was flabbergasted by your comment on the opening of the dialogues with this, you know, this statement about 2 hours before the curtain, you know, discovering about your father. So I was like, what is going to be an image that I can sort of, you know, compose or somehow relate to it? Because I think that there's some underlying, like you said, white elephant somewhere is going to be there anyway. So... that's what I chosen, partly based on some images that you mentioned yourself in the dinner with Andrea, and partly related to something that has been, in some sense, long dormant and potentially can come to life.
Long dormant?
Dormant, I mean, the way that it sounds that you discovered about your distant father, something that, you know, was sort of out of any sense of perception that the, you know, Jew in Germany in mid-30s would work for Hitler, you know. That's, you know, whatever that would mean, you know. But so can you open?
Before. Oh. And I should just say what comes to mind.
Yes, whatever.
I would say I see a very old shaman. I also see a man in disguise. I see death in the eyes and pollution in the face, as if he has some terrible disease.
Shingles?
Is that a beginning?
Yes, that's a good beginning. You know, death already. We have a shaman, death, yes.
And I see the goat. But there's something rather frightening about this. That's all that comes for now. It's a goat that will lead me into the land of the dead. A goat king.
Goat king.
It also looks like Woody Allen.
It has this Hasidic kind of feel to it, yeah.
Yeah. But it's also the kind of thing that when you're a child, if you're a lonely child and you wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and it's winter time and the room is still dark and you see something on the back of the chair, which actually is really just clothes, but as the child you don't know it, that this creature could be watching you.
So it would be a very interesting guide to the land of the dead. I mean,
yes.
That kind of a goat.
Then. Yeah. And it could also be an old Jew in one of the camps.
Why that in particular? What reminds you of the
I think the beard.
The beard.
And the eyes, which are closed.
It's an intense presence, it seems.
Very intense, yeah. Well, of course, also, when I say the goat king that will lead you into the land of the dead, there's no doubt that the task of this... I just had my 75th birthday. The task of this particular time of my life is to try to somehow surrender or open to the fact that it's now late autumn in my life and that my world will end.
Oh, you devoted life to theater in some
yes.
sense. So, and the theater in the kind of background or kind of Nietzschean understanding of the theater is the song of the goat. I mean, that tragedy as goat song that somehow, and your exploration from early on to today, really trying to do something, open up authenticity on stage in a way, the way you spoke about Joseph's song, that he would stand and kind of radiate, or in a linear, with André, you talk about Eleonora Duse, that
yes.
She had this light coming that was just filling up people with emotion, with just by virtue of being on stage, that there was something that she was so open to some other dimension that it would come through. The technique, anything would kind of fall off, and the pure presence of the lighthouse would
Yes, because something that is interesting about Erland Josephson and Eleonora Duse, particularly Eleonora Duse for me, because Eleonora Duse, who you know was perhaps one of the greatest actresses of all time, and like me, she gave up the theater for 12 years, or the theater gave up her. She simply stopped. And when she came back to the theater, a couple of years before she died, people never talked about her performance. They said she was like light, she was like gossamer, she was, her presence wasn't quite, she was ethereal, you know. But as far as the simplicity goes, you know, there are two kinds of acting in a way. There's the acting where you're acting, the way most people act in life. But you don't find it funny. You do it to be polite. We have a mask on, and we present our mask to the audience. And then there are the actors who cannot be anything except in authentic simplicity. Like an iceberg, where you only see the tip, but below the tip is this huge mountain of human experience. You know, there was a story I always loved about Maria von Franz, which I'm sure you know. An artist once came to her, and he wanted to go into psychoanalysis, but he was afraid that the psychoanalysis would ruin his talent. And she said to him, don't be afraid of going into the unconscious. The unconscious is so vast that psychoanalysis and the investigation of the unconscious is simply like dipping a spoon in the ocean. So that in certain kinds of performance, you simply see the suggestion through utter simplicity, what Eliot talks about in the Four Quartets, through utter simplicity of this vast human terrain that lies underneath.
Funny that you mentioned the Four Quartets, because your quote brought to me another quote from Four Quartets that goes something like, had they deceived us or deceived themselves, the quiet-voiced elders bequeathing us merely with a receipt for deceit. Because at least in my projection on the quote, there was something about you and your father that was a certain kind of a background, as it were, saying something underneath that was never came to the surface.
In the story with my father.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, well, of course, family secrets. Well, we have one of the great experts on family secrets in the room. My wife, Cindy Klein, who has done an extraordinary film. Probably one of the most devastating and funny films about marriage. It's about her parents' disastrous 50-year marriage. It's a combination of Ingmar Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage and the Marx Brothers' A Night at the Opera. It opens in New York in late February. It's called Phyllis and Harold. But Cindy, like myself, her life has been dedicated to investigating the secrets and bringing the truth to light. And in my own work with the actor, what I am most interested in is the subtext. In other words, you get a simple line of text. Harry goes home. He's forgotten his keys. He rings the bell. His wife answers the door. And he says, "Hi, honey, I'm home." The simplest line of dialogue. But an entire world lies under that, "Hi, honey, I'm home." The subtext is what's interesting.
On the background of this image, I mean, Jung thought about it as a fossil.
Of this image?
Yes, this is a fossil of a particular character that he calls Atma Victu, a breath of life. That this is one of kind of creative forces that comes into the psychic world or the world at large and brings something new and then withdraws. And this is the withdrawal moment of that figure.
Oh, he's withdrawing.
He's withdrawing. I mean, that's how Jung talks about. The description says that this is the other side of another image, and this is the shadow side of a very kind of, you know, jewel of light, if you wish. Mm-hmm. And this is what's the shadow of light. So when you talk about the light radiating from the certain depth of the person, the somewhere, there is other side to that, I imagine. And in your experience of your father, there is probably something in the background that seeing as a young child some strange face on the clothes. I mean, you can see all kinds of things, but things that we see respond to something, and your response about death or being guided by, unlikely guide. It's, you know, a goat mm-hmm. is, you know, it's not, I don't know, you know, as a goat, as a actual animal, what does it know about death? But that, you know, definitely is a...
Yes, well, of course, in The Shining, I once met Kubrick, and I said, "Mr. Kubrick, thank you so much for making a documentary about my childhood." And he said, no, dear boy, it's a documentary about my childhood. But what's interesting to me about the film is that, as you may remember, if you saw the movie, there are all these horrible things in this awful house. There's mm-hmm. blood coming out of the walls. There are monsters who run out into the hall. And it always seemed to me that, of course, the father is mad. My own father was bipolar. That when these things aren't said, children pick them up and make them into imagery. So that in some way, for me, the horror of this movie is that the house is haunted. It's haunted by this man who is nuts and who is dangerous. I, for instance, was born in Paris and lived in Paris until 1939. I also have to mention that what is particularly difficult about this issue with my father is that, of course, he brought all of us to America. So even had he been some kind of associate of Hitler's, I would not be here. My brothers would not be here if it hadn't been for him, you know. But our first 5 years were in Paris, the city of light, the city where everyone loves to go, the city of romance, the city of beauty, the city of great food. I hate it. I hate everything about it. And I think that's probably because, well, it's partly, of course, because our family being Jewish, even though I didn't realize it because I was so young, were facing the terrors of whether or not to leave. So in that sense, the house was also haunted by the horrors that were coming to Europe. But I may also have picked up certain things about the father or the mother. Incidentally, I always describe my mother and father as Macbeth and Lady Macbeth.
Quite the family.
Beckett said, nothing is funnier than unhappiness. We should stop there.
It's hard to imagine what it would mean now for your father. I mean, being a Jew in Europe, you know, of that time, and potentially, you know, engaging with the ultimate, talking about the evil that we don't recognize anymore in the West. That, you know, if there's any evil that has been present, the Hitler definitely represented it for the West since the time, of the 20th century. So that character, your father as a character dilemma, what this character, talking about the simple line, coming home, honey, I am home. I don't know what it would be like, or coming to see you, for one of the times that he saw you, saying something, from that background, from that kind of attention.
Well, he was also, a brilliant man, because he left the Soviet Union 4 months before Stalin came to power. He left Berlin the day Hitler came to power, so it's not as if he didn't know who Hitler was. He left Paris with us a week before the Germans invaded Poland. We went to England. We got the last boat out of England. Our sister ship was torpedoed, so as a child, I saw people drowning between that ship and this ship, and we came to Scarsdale. Moscow, Paris, London, Scarsdale. And during the Reagan years, when he was in his 80s, he said to me that if he were young, he would leave America, and which seemed ominous. And I said, why would you leave? And he said, first, because each political party is so corrupt, it can only lead to fascism of some religious nature. And since he came out of the Soviet Union, he was able to see with the kind of clarity that many of us can't. For instance, when Kennedy was killed, I went to visit him, and he was watching, he was watching everything that was happening, and Oswald had just been arrested. And my father said, they won't let him live for 48 hours. Ruby shot him, and my father said, he'll never go on trial. He'll die in prison. So this was also, I'm sure you knew many people like this in Poland, who, because of the horrors of the Polish experience, had a clarity of vision that many in this country would not have, because we've never been bombed.
So there was something about this perception of this another Pole, seeing you as a sadist optimist, that, given the background of Shining, that you have a sense of humor.
Well, yes, a sense of humor is essential. And a sense of humor is sexy. My wife is very, very sexy because she's very, very funny. In relation to my wife, once I was giving a lecture And in the Q&A, somebody said to me, I'm so moved by your feminine side. And I said, well, it isn't really my feminine side. I said, my wife calls me her lesbian lover.
Now you're in a position. So I don't know what we are doing here, but given that now you're in a position in terms of the 75 birthday and kind of approaching the autumn of life and kind of looking back, I imagine part of that process is, and you're receiving that kind of a gift. Put it this way, this was something mm-hmm. that was given to you and that comes from the dormant space, from the space of the grave, from the dead father.
Yeah.
And it comes into your life now. What does it, where does it lead you in a way? Where that, at this point, that your father is, you know, in that kind of, in a fossil condition?
You know, I don't know because... I'm still in the middle of it, in a way. I mean, I did realize that, you know, Wally Shawn and I are like Abbott and Costello. I've been doing his work for 40 years, and I always thought that I did his plays because, A, I believe he's the greatest stylist in the American theater, and really I feel our greatest playwright. Since Tennessee Williams. But I always felt I was doing it for Wally because I so admired his plays and because we're such colleagues. When I got this information, I suddenly realized for the first time that the three last plays I've done of Wally's, one of the central characters is a sociopath, another character is a sadistic narcissist, I have a good time. And the third character, an Ibsen play, is simply everything that is frightening about the closed male ego. So I did discover why I do these plays, you know. But where I suppose it could be leading to some kind of discovery about myself that I haven't known. For instance, I'm terrified of anger and of rage because there's been so much. Now I'm a very happy man. I really am, but a joyful man. But there has been an enormous amount of buried rage in me. And I have always thought that that was because, you know, I was brought up. You know, there was a wonderful movie in the 1940s about a mother and a father and a child who are traveling in a little plane over Africa. And the plane crashes, the parents are killed, and the boy is brought up by baboons. So I... So I myself never I was never touched, I was never caressed, I was never hugged. I was like that wild boy with the baboons to such an extent that when I was at college, I fell in love with a very beautiful, very brilliant woman at Radcliffe. We went to lectures together, we went to dinners together, we were with each other all the time. But it never occurred to me that a beautiful, brilliant woman could love a monster. I think I saw myself as a kind of monster. In my teenage years, my parents would give me 50 cents to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I would take the 50 cents and I would go to a theater called the Rialto, where you would get triple bill horror movies, Frankenstein, Dracula, Bride of Frankenstein, because these were relatives. So anyway, it never occurred to me that she could have any tender feelings towards me, and I think she assumed I was gay because we went out every single day, night and day, you know, but I never touched her or took her hand. And one night, we went, on a very beautiful moonlit night, we went to a graveyard in Marblehead, Massachusetts, a romantic date. And she suddenly decided to just go for it. And she grabbed me and she kissed me. And the electrical charge and the shock were so great, I fainted. Now, how did we get onto that? Oh!
That's where your father is leading you.
Oh,
graveyard,
yes,
the, you know, around
way. The rage, this buried rage, which was great fuel for my work when I was young. It no longer is, but it really was a great source of my work when I was young. I think because I've been so afraid of rage, either because I wanted to kill my father or because I was afraid he would kill me, or both, that I have sat on this rage so that to a certain degree, I am still not the authentic human being that I could be. And I know when I heard this news, whether or not it's true, I felt enormous rage that my own father could make money off these sadistic scumbags. You know, so it could be leading towards an acceptance of the rage and letting it go. Otherwise, we'll see. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You had the image, you know, that you discussed in dinner with Andrea of the Minotaur coming mm-hmm. to the, I guess, to the Mass, the Christmas Mass. But it was a very lyrical creature. It had violets, you know, and some other flowers on the hooves. So it was a, you know, was a kind of powerful image of this bull, yeah. half man, the kind yeah. of rage, the ferocity, the aggression. But at the same, the little flowers. So mm-hmm. it was a kind of a moment that there was a, you know, opposites were almost unified. There was this more feminine lyrical side, you know, the lesbian
part. Well, you know, it's interesting because on purpose I didn't read anything about the Red Book. I didn't find out anything about it because I wanted to be as clean or clear as possible. And but it did occur to me. Jim Hillman spent Thanksgiving with us, and he was telling me about how the Red Book came into being, and of Jung facing these strange, frightening creatures, would you say?
Yeah. Well, the terror is all over the book.
Yeah. So that something that people don't realize now, I think, it occurred to me that I made my own Red Book, and that my Red Book was my dinner with Andre, and that the Red Book, my Red Book, came out of the fact that I was suddenly seeing things that made me question my own sanity. In fact, one of my best friends, had lunch with my first wife and suggested that I be committed to that nice asylum in Lenox, Massachusetts. But I did not know if I was psychotic, if I was going out of my mind. Like Jung, I kept many diaries with drawings in them. I didn't know where this was leading. It felt as if it was leading me towards madness. I told very few people about them. When you see My Dinner with Andre, of course, you're already seeing a film that is enormously successful, and the two of us, in a way, are social caricatures, because we're sitting and we're having conversation and fun and everything like that. But the story of the flag in the movie that I imposed with great shame on my daughter, these apparitions, these images, were in fact absolutely terrifying and disorienting. There was a great Soviet director, Meyerhold, who was, you know, like the Leonardo da Vinci of theater directors, and every night when the whole house was asleep, I would go into a dark room with a little candle, and I would talk to Meyerhold, who was long dead, and his voice would come through me. I think that these experiences, my own Red Book, was not just leading to a film, My Dinner with Andre. I think that I was being forced, often terrified, into realizing that there is a spiritual world, that Saint-Exupéry says, what is visible is invisible to the eye, that whatever we might call God or what have you is in the blood cells. And because I had denied, I had no interest in a spiritual world, because I had denied this, these visions were coming to me to force me into the direction where finally, because of my daughter who's here tonight, I was actually able to get a guru. I can identify with Jung's motivation for creating this book, because I myself went through very terrifying years where I had no profession, nothing to do, was seeing visions, didn't know why, had never heard of this before, had no background in it, you know.
But based on your experience, wouldn't you say that the madness now as an experience, not something that to be isolated, being removed from, but madness as a human experience is an essential part of the human experience, not just the something that never go there, because when you go there, you lose yourself, of course, you lose your identity, you lose, you know, who you believe you are, but it's an essential identity-forming phenomenon that it's been in for the kind of the enlightenment position on the subject, that only rational aspect of experience is worth exploring, as it were, or extending everything to the rational experience, that something in madness, it's facing it and actually going through it with this terror, not knowing what will come out on the, whether you come out on the other end, that is essential to forming that kind of sense of authenticity that you, it seems, strive toward?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely essential. And I think... I think that when we don't go through it, we impose it on the collective. That there is a kind of madness in America now. We could call it a civil war, but it's also a kind of madness. There's a madness in the world. There is, of course, Muslim fundamentalism, and there's American fundamentalism, which I think is extremely dangerous. And I think perhaps this comes because of the fear of dealing with the madness that is in me, each one, that this is simply a part of us.